Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. This podcast is for you if you have an insane drive to find the truth of things. It's not the good answers that we seek, but the good questions. I interview a range of different guests from many different fields, all with the intention to uncover the simple truths that are hidden in plain sight. Most people don't want to go there. I go there. My guests go there, and you benefit. Please let me know if you enjoy these episodes, and as always, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the podcast. Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. My guest today is Nilrun Mardux out of Aleph Dao. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Stuart. Big fan of the show. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, very excited to talk about a lot of different things. We could talk about the kind of what's it like as a foreigner living in Argentina. We can definitely go into geopolitics, the new internet, kind of sovereign individual type of stuff. And then also very exciting is the difference between Keynode, Plunder, and Urbit. It's going to be really interesting. Let's go into the expat thing because that's the most relevant for me right now. What is your experience in Argentina and how is it going? How'd you find it?
Yeah, well, I mean, Argentina wasn't the first place that I went to expatting. Like a lot of American expats, I started in Mexico. That was in October 2020. And then ended up through a sibling going over to Ukraine in like July 2021. And then, you know, got residency in Ukraine, got residency in Mexico, was kind of just going to pair the two. And then the war happened. I kind of got bored of Mexico. One of my friends who I was hanging out with during this period, he was also an expat, he wanted to like go to Argentina. He was fascinated by Argentina. I had been in 2010 for a university summer abroad. So like 2.5 months in Argentina and mostly in Buenos Aires. And I don't know, I liked it, but I was kind of a poor student and couldn't really enjoy the fact that it's way cheaper here. Yeah, it took me until 2022 when I came down to Argentina with that friend and then ended up meeting my current wife, really falling in love with the country and just kind of getting past all of the FUD that is actually mostly spread by Argentines. It's not even really spread, you know, by like random people on Twitter. It's a lot of the Argentines kind of FUDding about their country being like, you can't come here. It's terrible. And then, you know, the lived experience has been the complete opposite.
It's just like it's a total, I love it here. And I've been thinking the past couple of days of how it's kind of like an alternative universe to California. Both Brazil, Southern Brazil, and Argentina are very similar to California in the sense that they're very distant. And they're like, when you're in California, you don't feel that you are really connected to the rest of the world. You're just like off on this Western side, like really far away. And then I was thinking, oh, but the Atlantic, like where Argentina and Brazil are, it's on the Atlantic and the Atlantic's really known. But then I realized, oh, it's really far south too.
Far south.
Yeah. So it's just like off the map for most people and it's too far. Nobody wants to come here. Just too far away. What do you think?
Yeah. We're like as far south as South Africa. It's like the tip of like Cape Town. It's crazy. And then, you know, you have that and then you have, everyone's always wondering like, why is it so expensive to go to Argentina? Like, it's not just there are direct flights to tons of places, but because of the crazy tax regime of Argentina, they've enhanced that isolation. Mm. You know, while I could get to California pretty cheaply as an East Coaster in the US, getting to Buenos Aires is expensive. And so it creates this sort of unique, I don't know, almost like bubble that is the Argentina Southern Cone where lots of people come for tourism, but there's not the same experience as when I was living in Mexico City where people were coming for like 2 days. And there was sort of this feeling of, oh yeah, I'm like right next to the US. I can just come and go. There's more of a sort of fixed social scene here.
But do you think that that's going to change? Like, do you think this in 5 years, this is going to be like Mexico City?
I think in certain aspects, definitely not, just because of that kind of weekend ability to go to Mexico City from almost any US city. There were a lot of friends, just like college roommates, who'd pop by Mexico City in a way that they don't in Buenos Aires. But I think for the long-term expats, the Buenos Aires situation is better because you filter out a lot of the noise. Yeah. These people who have no intention of staying, you run into them at like a expat meetup, some maybe a crypto event, but it's like, oh yeah, I'm here for like a day. And I'm just, you're like, all right, what are we going to do with this? Whereas the social scene here, as you've seen too, you can host a meetup, tons of people attend because there is a massive expat scene here, but then the same people come back, the same people are coming back because they're here long term.
No, it's totally wild, and it's really interesting the because there's a different, 'cause I love Argentines. I love hanging out with Argentines. It's the same vibe as Brazil. I get a little bit more reserved, a little bit more introverted, but once you get to know them, they're in the, on the inside, it's very, very similar to Brazil. It's much harder to be in social relationships with Argentines for me, particularly because I go to sleep very early, and Argentines do not. So it's like I can't accept invites. I do accept invites, but it's very rare that I'll accept an invite to an Argentine event. But then there's this just like giant group of expats who are mixed between long term and short term. And those long term are really interesting. And let's get into this, because there's a vibe to it that's essentially very interesting, unique. I haven't pinpointed yet. There's been a lot of metaphors thrown around about how it's kind of like Paris in the 1920s. My take is it's Paris in the 1920s mixed with cyberpunk, sort of like apolitical technology solutions that are taking over, mixed with this weird, interesting kind of sociopolitical thing that seems new. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's one of those instances, right, of like history, never repeats, but it rhymes. And so we are having a little bit of this aspect of like 1920s Paris, where like, look, you can live in a cosmopolitan city like Buenos Aires that's like nice. It's safer than most. It's definitely safer than New York. If you're in CABA itself, not just looking at the provincial numbers. So it's safer. It's incredibly cosmopolitan. Architecture is beautiful. Like I went to Paris after living here for a few months. Like I moved here full time last July after several kind of shorter trips. And then I went to Paris in October on my honeymoon, and I was just like struck. I'm like, oh, this kind of feels like Buenos Aires. Like, why did I come to Paris? I like already have this vibe living in Buenos Aires from sort of the architecture, the ridiculous number of like cafes and bars, and like the sort of, I don't know, like, yeah, you're getting a lot of that positive. Like something I really liked about visiting New York. I have a lot of friends who live in New York now. It's just like high social liquidity, where you could like go to one event and bounce to the next. And Buenos Aires has that. I think that's why, a lot of the, we can kind of go into these archetypes of expats that we're finding here who are, like getting to know better. But there's something about a lot of people came here for like a couple weeks, and then they just stayed, and now they're staying like indefinitely. And there's not even, and the Argentines aren't kicking them out, unlike what happened to you in Brazil, right? Or what almost any country does to
Yeah, exactly. That's the
you.
weird thing. It's in the Constitution. Like, it's in the actual Constitution. Maybe you know this more
It's,
than
yeah,
I
it's
do. Yeah.
crazy.
I heard there's a whisper that, like, if you're European, then you are more protected by the Constitution. Is that right? Do you know?
I'm not positive on that front. I wouldn't be surprised. Argentina is famous for expelling all of their African Argentines at one point.
Did
So it
they?
definitely has like a
Oh.
strong, yeah. I forget exactly which president did that, but that's why until the Venezuelans came, like when I came in 2010, there were no black people in Argentina, for better or worse, there just
Whoa.
weren't any. And so we had one black student on our study abroad from Kenya, and people were taking photos of him. This is 2010. So there's sort of, it was sort of this European focus. And the Argentines, unlike the Mexicans, they're extremely like, they want to think of themselves as European. They kind of look to Europe at all times. And, they're extremely welcoming to kind of European people for that reason. I'd say welcoming to most, but it seems particularly like, I don't know, like they want to identify with you and hang out with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so funny because it's coming from the US. You got the whole the giant racism sort of category that can be placed on it, a bunch of different stuff. But I don't find Argentines to be racist. Like, I think what you're saying is that they're essentially they gravitate towards Europeans in the same way that Thais do as well. like Thai people, they also look towards that. And so it reminds me of another story. I was doing research about the difference between Brazil and Argentina and how their histories changed, and then how that's between the United States and Brazil and Argentina as well. And one of the most interesting things I learned was that Buenos Aires was on the slave trade route, so they did have a lot of slaves, but it was
Interesting.
only inside of Buenos Aires, because of the gaucho culture, because of all the immigrants, because of this like giant land, and also because of the products that they developed, cattle and wheat, didn't take a whole bunch of labor. Whereas sugar in Brazil, that required a huge amount of labor. The South and the United States, the same thing. So
Yeah,
slavery
with cotton,
didn't happen in the South.
tobacco, sugar, really labor intensive. Yeah, it's sort of like in the American West, right? Texas didn't have
Yes,
a
exactly.
ton of slaves working in the cattle industry. That just
Yeah,
wasn't,
interesting.
you didn't necessarily need to import slaves to, yeah, to make that work.
And then in Buenos Aires, at one point, they stopped slavery really early, actually, here. And then all of the African Argentines essentially were in Buenos Aires. And that's actually, I believe, I haven't been able to actually figure out the truth on this, but that's where tango came from, in the same way that samba and jazz came from the local slave populations that had been freed.
No, interesting.
Tango also happened that way on the Rio Plata, but that it might be a myth. Like I can't figure it out.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know. I haven't heard that story yet. I mean, obviously the tango industry is huge here, and like somewhat bizarrely, like the best maintained guide on everything to kind of do in Argentina, and like visas, just like a lot of guides, a lot of like the really good alpha on how to live in Argentina comes from the tango community, because they're like these expats who just came down here to tango. They're obsessed with tango and they love it. And yeah, they stayed for that reason.
And that's a very good point, because that essentially the tango scene is so interesting, and this relates to the network state kind of thing that we can get into, which is that tango has created a special economy here. I can go to a 20 an osteopath slash chiropractor slash medically trained massage therapist with a doctorate, for 20 USD. But if I want to go get a tango lesson, the cheapest that I've ever found is 30 USD for a very, very good teacher. But most of the time I'm quoted like $90 per hour or $135 an hour. And that's specifically because Buenos Aires has attracted this subgroup, this niche of tango dancers for, I know, ever since the 1950s, maybe. And so that's really interesting. This gets into the network state, which I think we're gonna have a lot of fun talking about as well, because it's so in our lives down here. What's your take on that, and the network state, how it relates to like subcultures and such?
I hadn't thought of tango as a network state, but if they're, yeah, they literally have their own housing, right? They have their own network, they have their WhatsApp groups. They're operating like most of the function of a community, and even borderline like government with the tango community down here. And it's such a salient, it's so intrinsic to a lot of these people's identity. And in terms of like the network state, I think one of the silly things about the first edition of Balaji's book, The Network State, was just how he gives the example of like a kino community, and that's going to be like a network state that like eventually, gets like UN recognition. And that's just like ridiculous. That's just so stupid. But then you see there are some ties that are strong that do pull people in. I mean, ETH, for example. Or if I, I'll if I, I'll take the Miladies first, actually. I know a number of Miladies, and they have a lot of similar values, a lot of alignment, and they had sort of this routine event, to kind of bond, get together, is the Milady raves that would happen across the world. And so there are these network states that are appearing. I just think the dialogue around the network state has actually like detracted and has actually like pushed us
Yes, I
further
agree.
back than some earlier writings. Like The Sovereign Individual, I think, is way more predictive for today. And that was written, borderline, what was that? More than 20 years before, about 25 years before Balaji wrote his book. And then you have Curtis Yarvin's writing around, why am I drawing a blank, but sort of competition between nations to attract sort of people. And so those two thinkers, I think, were further. And then Balaji, and I think Balaji, he's done a service in terms of
Yeah, popularizing
more
it.
people now know about it. He's
Yeah.
kind of popularized it, as you said.
Yeah.
But I think, like, in terms of the concrete action items, right, for people that want to kind of thrive in this new age we're entering, you know, we called it the network age on our podcast back in the day. And I still don't know if we have the best term for this new age, but there's some realities, right, that the sovereign individual hit on first, where like we are seeing competition between states. We are seeing, you know, El Salvador is the most famous example of this, that's, you know, legalized Bitcoin, has passed, you know, decided to basically compete with the rest of Latin America on safety, right? So they arrested their criminals, put them in jail, and became safer than the United States and on par with Canada in the span of about like a 2 year period. And that has sent shockwaves across Latin America, right? Because Latin America, like, this problem for us expats is like, what places are safe and what places have good community? We kind of talked about community a little bit already. Obviously, the tango subculture has it. I think we have it too with our meetups that we both run. But there's also this like question, you know, within Latin America, like what places are actually like safe enough or have good enough healthcare, have these kind of like the core foundation to scale such that they can attract people in waves of immigration that Argentina had, you know, about 100 years ago. It was attracting huge waves of immigration, similar to the US. I mean, take my wife's family. They were immigrants who came around 1905. So some came from the Russian Empire, and then her mom's side was coming from France, actually. So her great grandmother came from post World War I France. Her brother had died in World War I. She wanted out. There was a French guy courting her from Buenos Aires. So she married the French guy, moved to Buenos Aires. And it was out competing the US for large numbers of immigrants. And I think that's what's been a missing piece. Like, we could kind of go into the theory of sovereign individual network state, but there's been sort of a lack of actual places that can make these theses true. And I think we're still at a very early stage for this.
Okay. This is really interesting. Do you know in that time period, 1905, 1920s, or late 1800s, was it popular among the upper class as well as the middle and lower classes to come to Argentina, or was it only the middle and lower class?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have the best data on that. I think if you look at the British, there was a good book like The British in Argentina that a friend shared, another sort of
Oh,
American
interesting.
expat. Yeah, really good book talking about the British community in Argentina that was extremely strong. Argentina was, you know, it was actually the number one place for British foreign investment before World War I. The British built the railroads, safe drinking water. They invested huge amounts of capital and mostly towards the export economy of Argentina. But you know, Buenos Aires was, you know, per capita richer than the US in 1905. There was a ton of wealth coming, and like, so who did it attract? There were upper class British coming for sort of the commercial interests. I think in terms of Italians, it seems like actually it did skew more middle and upper class Italians moving to Buenos Aires and Argentina versus the groups that moved to the United States, especially the Eastern United States. But it was overall, and then if I look at, you know, my wife's family, they were, you know, that group of French, right? Her great grandmother and great grandfather, they had options, you know. Her
Got it.
great grandmother's lived on the Champs-Élysées. It was like her home address, if you look at the letters to that, you know, during the courtship. And so it's like, yeah, she had options. And for whatever reason, Buenos Aires was a better option than the United States in that point for a lot of people.
That's super interesting. Okay, so let's go back to the sovereign individual, these communities. I actually haven't read Balaji's book. I haven't read Sovereign Individual, but I talk so much about this topic, and it's really interesting. Because it's not a state. It's not. What's the difference between 1990s and now that makes this a big thing? Like, is it, it? I imagine the my assumption is that it no longer has geographical borders, and that's basically the main point that I have is that, okay, it's now transnational. Is that it, or is there something else?
Yeah, well, I think if we take a step back, I mean, you're obviously sort of secondhand familiar with the sovereign individual. I would just say, like, what was the sovereign individual's like main point? It was talking about how returns on violence, Right. And how during the 20th century, there was a ton of return on violence where, like, the Soviet Union could take over a new country and just kind of like
Yes,
force
interesting.
them to work in factories. And that was actually productive in a way that today, Russia trying to take the Ukraine on a similar model, like, isn't really helping their
Destroying both.
GDP.
Yeah, interesting. Destroying both. Well,
Yeah.
that might be a inaccurate assumption. I'd be curious because I mean, it's definitely seems like it's destroying Ukraine. It also seems like it's not tenable for Europe to continue doing what it's doing and the United States to do it. And it also seems that way in Russia, but it would be interesting to go do a
It's
full
putting
analysis.
a lot of pressure, right,
Yeah.
on all systems. And
Yep.
Russia, you know, I guess fortunately for Russia, from their perspective, when you go to war, like, commodity prices go up, and their main source of funds is, you know, selling gas and oil. So it's maybe less harmful than it's been for Europe, whose source of funds is manufacturing. Now their raw energy inputs are so much higher than they were pre-war. So they're just not really competitive with Asia, and like Mexico now. So there's like that dynamic. And but overall, it's like it's this idea of there's diminishing returns to violence because we can protect, because average people can protect their wealth. And this is really clear. Let's continue with that
Yeah.
example of like the Russia and Ukraine war. But then we could also, for our own life in Argentina, it's so clear. But from the Russian war perspective, you know, when they invaded Ukraine, actually my brother was living in a Kyiv suburb. And he quickly left. He left that morning, and most of his wealth left with him versus the people who had invested in
Yes.
factories,
Yeah.
physical assets within Ukraine that, you know, were either taken over by the Russians or, you know, an apartment in Kyiv isn't worth as much as it was before the war because there's just fewer people, less demand. And so it was fascinating living in Kyiv in that pre-war period. I left at Christmas, 2021, so 2 months before the war, you know, started. And everyone was talking about buying property, right? And it wasn't
Whoa.
until, and so it was all like, man, property is like great here in Kyiv, like it's pumping. And there was this debate among all of like the young, you know, like
That's it.
techies, entrepreneurs, everyone
Yeah.
about where you should invest. And we saw very quickly which was the better investment. It was crypto, because you could take it, you can memorize 12 words and take it with you across borders with no problem. Or have it on a thumb drive. You can't do that with property. You can't do that with gold. You can't do that with most assets. And so that, I think the sovereign individual was most clearly revealed in that war, but this has been the case. This is now true for people in all sort of conflict type zones. And the same for Argentina, right? So Argentina, what was the big problem as an expat living in Argentina? Well, they have really strict capital controls, right? It was kind of it from the outside, it looks really hard to get money into Argentina. Now, what that ended up doing, right, was obviously people don't want to hold pesos because it had 300% annual inflation last year. And sometimes, you know, it dropped 50% in like a week, which is great for us expats at the time, but terrible for the locals. And so they mostly store their wealth in dollars, physical dollars. The Argentines hold 200 billion physical US dollars, and they hold now tons of crypto. And crypto is how they're getting around the capital controls. And it's how a lot of the expats are also getting around it, because it's not illegal to have crypto here. And so it's actually pretty low percentages. It was even free recently to for a friend to exchange $30,000 in
Wow.
USDT into physical US dollar, $100 bills in Buenos Aires, right? So that was a free transaction, because, and then at most it costs 4%. That's the most I've ever seen. It's required. And so it lets you save your wealth. It also lets us bring our wealth from the outside without the risk, right? The risk that the Argentines do something crazy and we get screwed.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think a war is going to happen. But, you know, it's there was some risk early on when we were expatting here that Massa would win the election, that they would kind of go in a Venezuela type route. And fortunately, they overwhelmingly voted against that route. You know, Milei won by 14%. And now suddenly Argentina went from this kind of like, maybe it's going to be Venezuela, to now it's like the next El Salvador, but it's like a bigger country with amazing cities,
And more
right? And so it's a
interesting.
totally different picture. Yeah, and
Yeah.
fascinating.
Yeah.
There's no tango community or AI communities or entrepreneurship happening at this scale in the other countries that have been
Yes.
following the sort of sovereign individual playbook.
Yeah. And for me personally, that's why I'm so attracted to this place, is that it has all the things that I love about Brazil, but it's got also this just amazing epic city that fills all of the boxes, except for everybody goes out really late. That's the only imperfection in my plan. So it's really interesting. And okay, well, we got 14%. Yeah, so the chaos, because I was talking with my former boss yesterday, or maybe it was last week, and we had this great discussion about politics in Argentina, and politics with Milei, and is there a political solution? Up until I got here, I was like, okay, there's no political solution. We're just going to be, and that's what his theory is. It's that it's great, it's really interesting, really energetic, but then also it's just not, it's just not going to change anything, because there
His
is.
opinion as of yesterday.
It's yesterday or last week or
Okay.
such, but he doesn't know much
Okay, but recent.
about the situation. He hasn't he's only been here a week or two, and so he doesn't have this just like download that I've gotten from talking to everybody here and the energy here, which then that's really the most makes me most optimistic, is the energy. As long as we can get through the next few months where it's like really, really hard, it's actually my life isn't hard at all, but it like that. Right now, the economic situation is actually affecting my wallet, which causes like a little bit more stress. But for the Argentines, I have no idea how they're surviving right now, because none of it makes sense. Like, prices have doubled for me in the past 2 to 3 months, and their salaries haven't budged. So I'm like, as long as we can survive this next 2 or 3 months, and there's some change in salaries, then I think like what's happening here could actually represent a political solution. But that's an open question. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's the million-dollar question, right? Can Argent like El Salvador is the most dangerous country in the world, and it became s as safe as Canada. Like that's so. I do. I guess I'm an optimist. I didn't think that was going to happen in El Salvador. When they first legalized Bitcoin, I was interested. I was in the news, but I even being in Mexico at the time, I wasn't that interested in going to El Salvador. And it was only later, as I kind of got to know some Salvadorians through actually some Christian friends of mine, that I like decided to go to El Salvador for a month. But I was terrified getting off the airplane. Like I was so happy two Salvadorian friends were picking me up at the airport, because I was
Because
on edge.
you were there before it became fixed.
I was there like a month after the emergency law was passed. So I
Okay,
guess in
interesting.
hindsight, it was now getting safe, but there was only a month of data to go off
Got
of, and
it.
it just had its most dangerous day ever a month earlier, which was what triggered the emergency declaration. So the state of emergency law that's actually still in place in El Salvador. So now if we focus on Argentina, right? Argentina is the economic basket case. It's one of the richest, it's like the one of the richest per capita countries in the world, like top five, richer than the US in 1905. And now it's like, dude, like a teacher makes 500 a month here. Like it's nothing. There's 67%. There's so much poverty, right? I think it's about 60% poverty right now. But at the same time, you're sitting on a country that has insane natural resources. Like it produces enough food for 300 million people. It has a population of 45 million. It's already basically energy independent. It was actually one of the only countries in the world that had its own nuclear program. One of the only countries that sent a living mammal into space. That sent a monkey, I think, in the 80s. And so it's actually it's like, and it's very educated. So there's this weird, like, if you look at it at an average level, it looks bad. And then when you dig in, you're like, wow, there's so much opportunity here. And they're planning to basically be a massive energy exporter soon. Like they're sitting on very large Venezuela type levels of natural resources, with the skilled personnel and the government that's willing to exploit them, to cultivate them. I shouldn't say exploit, I would say develop, obviously. Like we need these resources. And so Milei has already balanced the budget. They're sitting on great agricultural exports at a time when Russia and Ukraine are in a huge war, and those were like two of the biggest exporting countries of food stock. And then you're sitting on, tons of natural energy resources. And and high human capital. So I'm optimistic. I also, one thing I've loved about living abroad, besides like the whole like you're living twice as well for half as much, right? Like my monthly budget here is like 1500 a month in like a renovated French apartment in my dream zone where I can walk everywhere. I don't need a car. Once I have my son in a month, like that doesn't even really impact my cost of living when I compare that to my siblings living in the US. And things have doubled, but I'm still at 1500 a month. And I'm lucky, obviously. I'm fortunate. The Argentines are going through a hard time, and it is really shitty for them, but I think they're sitting on one of the best
Potential.
hands. Is so much potential here. And I think we can help. I mean, your AI meetup, right? It's there's a lot of Argentines going there. My meetup, that's more like let's relax and play games. There's Argentines there. Like it's not in Mexico, I felt like we were so isolated
That
from
is
the
what I
Mexicans.
love
And
about
we're
it
like
here.
this. And here it just feels like, man, it's so easy to get along with the Argentines and the expats. Like there's this nice intercultural exchange that's not forced, there's no resentment. And so there's that. And then one thing I'd mention on the sort of living abroad, like something that was amazing about living in El Salvador for about a year was how easy it was to share ideas with their government, how open the government was to talking, and how it could be like, I don't know, the president's brother wants to hear your idea, or you're talking to like the main aide for one of the Bukeles, and you're just like, or he comes to your party and you're just like, man, the level of access to share ideas is so high in a way that you'll never access in the US or Europe. Like the bureaucrats don't give a shit about your ideas there. So if you're like I have a couple of friends now who are just like high-level advisors to the Salvadorian government because they decided to. Like these are Americans, and they're just like, hey, let's go on an adventure, let's try to help this country. And Argentina, I think, is interestingly placed. You mentioned, potentially getting. Well, I think this is actually before we started recording. You mentioned, going through residency, getting citizenship. I now have permanent residency, and I already started my citizenship application. And so there's, and the Argentines, the only barrier to advising the Argentine government would be just like having a good idea and maybe speaking some Spanish. Like you'll be as Argentine as a lot of the others. Like there's this welcomingness to immigration and to the ideas of immigrants. So I'm pretty bullish. I think the core in this though is places that can actually attract, like there's so many countries where you could live, but there's only a few places that are attracting really smart, interesting people who can also stay and really put down roots and invest in those places.
And that's the strange thing about this place is that in the same way that Brazil is extremely welcoming, and not only welcoming, but it's sort of like a mind virus where you by the second generation you are Brazilian or you are Argentine or you are the United States, you're American or you're Canadian. And it's so interesting because it's the only country where I've felt welcome, and it's only very far away, or it's only very like a 2-hour flight from a place where I've also felt very welcome by everything except the bureaucracy. And here, the bureaucracy is very welcoming as well, which is
Yeah, there's this like 2x2 matrix, right? Where it's like, do the people want you there? And then does the government want you there? Then on the, negative side, it's like Mexico. Like the government actually kind of does want you there,
interest. Yes, it does.
but most of the people don't, especially like the upper class Mexicans. The locals are fine, nice, but the upper class Mexicans have this sort of anti-gringoism to them that, yeah, just I didn't feel welcome, even though I, am a Mexican resident before. So yeah, I'd say that 2x2 matrix. So that's like one area I would look at. I think if we kind of talk broadly about visas, passports, right? There's so many people offering these services. Like there's Nomad Capitalist. That's how I first kind of encountered that kind of world of visas and passports. But there's a lot of other people. I think you interviewed Botide Mara, who has, a really nice site about different visa programs, different passport programs. There's, man, Sovereign Citizen. He just got bought by like Peter. There's so many people offering these services, but then what I find is like the missing piece is people just need like, just someone to advise them through this. Like it's actually really it's really specific on the person's actual, on like their job, on what their current passport is, on where they really want to live, whether they know where they want to live yet. Some conversations, we've had just like informally, but I've done this now with a lot of people, just trying to figure out, what is the best country for them, both, and then how could you potentially maybe get tax residency and a visa in one place, sort of set a flag there, like a country like El Salvador or Paraguay, but then live in your kind of dream place like Brazil or Argentina, or maybe it's Western Europe. So I think that's been missing in the current picture. And I think they're just like, I don't know why exactly, but I run into so many people that don't realize that, for example, the Americans, we can just exclude, about 140,000 in income from federal taxes. We can get out of state taxes by setting up in a zero, by moving abroad, and we can still travel back to the US for like 4 months a year off of that. And so there's so little knowledge about these sort of these things that you pick up when you're living abroad. And the fact that, a lot of these visa programs are not hard due to the fact I was trying to set up in Mexico and Ukraine. Like I did both those visas. I'd done a Canadian visa back in 2018 when I'd co-founded a startup and most of our devs were in Canada. That wasn't that hard. And now I've gone through permanent residency here in Argentina. It's you can get visas. It's like not that big a barrier,
Yeah. Okay. It's super interesting. So let's go into how things might change too. And this goes back to the kind of network state you mentioned, Ukraine. Ukraine kind of surprised a lot of people. And there it doesn't seem like there's many surprises down here outside of the realm of the economic and potentially the political, but it doesn't seem like it's a violent political change that's possible here. It doesn't feel like Brazil and Argentina or Brazil or Ch Argentina and Chile are going to go to war. But who knows?
No, no.
Who knows what could happen? But then there's the really interesting thing, which is that I've been starting to get whispers that the immigration thing, the visa thing, might change here with Malay. Mostly due to the fact that South Americans in general just come here and completely abuse the system because it's free here, free healthcare, free education. And so I think it's mostly focused at other Latin American countries, but I think it could also have some blowover effect to all the many expats here who have found out about the secret paradise. What do you think about how things might change coming here?
Yeah, from let's focus on the visa perspective first. I would say on the visa perspective, the current reality today is somewhat ridiculous that you can just live on a tourist visa and overstay, and that constitutionally, it's not a crime to overstay. And then all you do is you pay the fine whenever you leave. I know a lot of people who have been here for over 10 years living on the tourist visa. And if you check like the Facebook expat groups, there's so many people doing that. And so basically, yeah, the current situation is extremely good on that aspect. It also does have a legal route to residency that, is a little slow, a little bit of a pain, but it doesn't really have that high of an income requirement. It's about 1500 to 2K a month, that most people just have, like that amount of income if you're a Westerner
Living
is
in
really
Argentina.
not a high barrier. And then you could even, funnel your savings, right? You could just move savings from one bank account to another. So it looks like you have that amount. This isn't financial advice, residency advice, follow laws, but like I know of people who have done that. And so the overall visa situation's good. The most people structure their visa programs based off of the minimum income of the country. So the Mexicans do that. I'm pretty sure Argentina does that too. And so as the minimum income changes, that can up the barrier, but the minimum income here is so low. So like the Mexicans raised it closer to like 4,000 a month, but it's kind of unlikely that like salaries double in a year. It would be great for the Argentines if it happened, but I think basically your route, most people's route to a legal visa here, will still exist. Some maybe the tourist visa gets tweaked, but there's still one really important thing to keep in mind is like, what is the barrier to getting rid of you as like an expat? And in Argentina, it's the constitution. They'd literally have to pass like a constitutional change to get rid of you. So like, that's just unlikely, right? It's just,
There
it's
might
hard.
be two small little kind of moves to make it more uncomfortable, but it's not like the fundamental thing isn't going to change.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, there's a great question that I had. Oh man, I've lost it. Something about what we were talking about how it's all kind of changing in flux, visas. Oh man. Yes, found
Related
it.
to Argentina. Okay, nice.
The remote thing, it's one of the craziest things that I can't wrap my head around is that Argentines can earn in dollars if they speak English. That they can
Yes.
escape this crazy system. That feels new. That's like a new thing that happened with
Definitely new
work. Yeah.
pandemic.
And in the pandemic definitely has something to do with that. Okay. But then I meet people on the street, meet Uber drivers or meet people who are really having crazy problems because obviously it's a crazy place to be, economically speaking. And it's just so interesting that there's this small abstract barrier. It's totally abstract. It's not, I mean, it is practical. It's like if you speak English, you can do this. But it's not only if you speak English, though. If you speak English and you're able to enter a specific subgroup of people who are interested in technology and how they speak, and financiers and business-oriented people, it also takes that knowledge. And yesterday was such an interesting experience for me for this, which is that if you have access to that, it also doesn't, it's not specifically related to Argentina. It's also people in the United States don't know how to enter this tech world because it's so weird. And so what's your take on this of just like this abstract thing of like remote work mixed with English, mixed with social engineering? Like what's your take on that?
Yeah, for sure. No, it's something I think about a lot. When I moved abroad, it was honestly, I just was going on a vacation to Mexico for a month. And then, because even with all the faults of Mexico City, it was still such a better place
Yes. Yeah.
than the
Yeah.
Northeast
Yeah.
during COVID,
Yeah. Okay.
that it was just like, yeah, I'm coming to Mexico. And
Yeah.
I still love Mexico City. I don't want to shit on it too hard. Like,
Yeah.
I do like
It's
Mexico and
great.
a lot of,
Great place.
yeah,
Yeah.
I like a lot of aspects. And the nature, like the hiking 20
Around
minutes of
it.
Mexico City was
Yeah.
amazing.
Beautiful. Yeah.
So I went there with my job. I didn't have to quit my job. I was working at a big healthcare IT company. It was a good job. Sovereign individual describes a good job as like you don't have to work that hard, you get paid a lot. So it was sort of that type of good job.
New
But it
goal.
was also,
Yeah.
and so remote work, that was because of the pandemic. I'd already been working remotely since the pandemic started. And so asking my boss, hey, can I go to Mexico, wasn't such a big deal. And then it was fine for a while. And eventually the company, maybe it's because it's in the healthcare space, it eventually said you have to be in the US. And then I left at that point. But I've been talking to a number of people. I mean, like what are foreigners doing abroad? A lot of them are working for US companies. There are a ton of US companies that will let you work abroad. Especially in certain areas like tech, even the subset of tech that is crypto is basically like totally fine with being international. Like the ETH community is extremely international. A lot of crypto projects are international, but it's a lot of fields have stayed remote even now that it's 4 years since the pandemic started. There's still, and a ton of people haven't gone back to the office in the US. Office capacity in major cities is at half
Wow.
pre-pandemic, so that which will trigger interesting things in the real estate market, of course.
Well,
That's,
we could
but
talk about that.
focusing,
Yeah.
yeah, we could jump to that in a bit.
Yeah.
That I think
Yeah.
that ties into Bitcoin's at an all-time high today,
Yes.
as of recording. So we could go into all these other interesting aspects that definitely help this remote life. But I would say I think you're right. I think it's English, but it's more than that. It's knowledge of these networks, and it's not even necessarily a skill set. Like in El Salvador, a
Yeah.
lot of
Yeah.
the people work in call centers. They make about 800 to 1,000 a month. And on that salary, you could actually live very well in Argentina. Like that's what a school director makes in Argentina. My budget, of 1,500 a month, like I don't have to scrimp that much. Like that's includes going out to dinner multiple times, meeting up with friends at bars, like a glass of wine here, it's like $3. So we could go into a little bit like the living twice as well on half as much. But just to finish up on the remote work, yeah, I think tons of people have this option. I was just hanging out before your AI meetup last Wednesday, chatting with a couple people who were at the cafe, And one of them, just got a job fresh out of college, just doing sort of like basic, grunt work operations for a startup. He can live great in Argentina on that. I could live on 20% what they're paying me in healthcare IT. I maybe even less, like borderline 10%, not quite, yeah, call it 20%, right? I can live a higher quality of life on an 20% the income I had in the US. So there's a ton of options. The Argentines I know who are doing well are tapping into that. The Ukrainians were doing quite well, mostly tapping into Western European software jobs. So there was actually really nicely renovated restaurants. Like there was optimism in the kind of young tech class of Ukraine. And then when I was hanging out at cafes, working from cafes in Kyiv, like you just hear the word crypto all the time. You look over at a monitor and like some dudes, he's like, they're doing like the. And then I actually Googled one. I Googled one of like the PowerPoints I saw, and it was like some UCLA student was like launching a token, and these were like the Ukrainian devs like building it. So there's just like the Ukrainians figured out how to do it. The Argentines are kind of figuring it out, but there's so much more room for them to tap into this. And it's this combination of it's crypto that lets them get the money into Argentina without the insane capital controls that take in a minimum 50%, but more like 70 to 80% if you really dive into the numbers. So crypto, they set up a foreign bank account. The money goes into that, usually a US bank account, and then they just very cheaply convert that into physical US dollars in Argentina and then slowly convert that into pesos to pay for things. It works great. So crypto has already met that use case in addition to the use case of kind of fleeing with your money that we talked about with Ukraine.
Interesting. So let's go into that. Argentina is so interesting. It's the first time I've ever used crypto for anything other than hodling. And it's just so interesting how that particular one works. But it has nothing to do with the currencies that I'm most interested in. It has to do with USDT on the Tron network. It's hard to find somebody on ERC20. And also, why would I use ERC20 now? Because it's like if I make a transfer, I lose half of my money by making the transfer. But Argentina is like crypto literate. All the young people know what it is. All the young people are saving. Like it's this place knows how crypto works in a way that the United States kind of knows because the young population does know a lot of it. But in a way that's daily, an actual useful part of their life. A lot of people are earning their dollars by having their companies in the US pay them in crypto. And then there's another one just like hanging out there in the ether, which is Nigeria. It's like huge usage, more than Argentina. And I was just talking to somebody yesterday that like the you can make payments, like most of them want Bitcoin when they're getting
Yeah,
paid.
it's fascinating. Because that's,
Yeah,
I
go
mean,
ahead.
I'm coming to Argentina from El Salvador, right? So El Salvador had legalized Bitcoin. I had downloaded like Lightning really early on. I was a huge fan. And, I still HODL Bitcoin.
Lightning.
Sorry, I'm getting a bit of echo there. Hey, sorry, we good? Can you hear me? Okay, we kind of cut out there for a second.
Go for it.
Maybe we'll edit from there and I'll just start with El Salvador. Yeah, so it's interesting you mentioned like actually using crypto, which most people don't. But when I was living in El Salvador, they had legalized crypto. They had a national crypto wallet, Chivo, which means cool there, but smelly here, as I'm reminded many times. In Argentine Spanish is totally unique. I kind of love it, like the Porteño attitude. I'm going full Porteño. Sipping my mates. But in El Salvador, the thing was like the government supported it, but the people didn't. So the people didn't really accept it. It's like kind of like we talked about with visas. There's these two, it's like the government and then there's the people. The people didn't really accept it. It was still useful. Like when I lived in El Salvador, I need to buy a car. It was much easier to use Bitcoin to get the money in than like my bank that I went through all this hassle to get a bank account there, and then I couldn't even. It wasn't even on Swift, I found out. So I spent like a day at a bank trying to like giving them my tax returns, everything to set up a bank account. And so this goes into like another thing that's just way easier living abroad. Like crypto for getting money in, like having an international bank account, it makes the process a lot more similar to just using our Western banking. That's awesome, you know? But then there's like the dream of, there's the three types of money. There's the store of value. We kind of talked about that. Should I buy a house or should I buy Bitcoin? Well, probably should have bought Bitcoin. Then there's, unit of account. What's your salary getting paid in? Like what's and most people are using the dollar. It depends a little bit on the country, but a lot of people now are using the dollar as your unit of account. This is what your salary is denominated in. And then you have the means of payment. Like, what are we actually transacting? How am I buying the stuff? And I think these actually can all live separately. Like, I think Bitcoin is an amazing store of value. I think it's a pretty bad unit of account in a good way because it just went up so much that, no business owner wants to be paying someone and then have to double it.
That's interesting.
And no employee wants to take half. So, like, a volatile money is amazing as it can be a great store of value, especially for young people like us who don't need it immediately. That's just classic portfolio management. Like, they used to say 60% stocks, 40% bonds, and that changes as you get older and the risk profile of the assets. But regardless, Bitcoin's amazing on the store of value. It's shitty as a unit of account. Interestingly, it's like pretty fine. It's okay as a means of payment. There were issues using Lightning. I'm like a little bit down on Lightning. Like, full disclosure, I'm a little down on Lightning. In some ways, maybe decentralized computing, maybe that's a segue into decentralized computing eventually, but maybe
Interesting.
that solves it. I love, they did build Lightning on Erbit recently. I think it through Tyrell, and through my friend Jake there at Tyrell. So, maybe decentralized computing, where you have your own servers and like you're sort of hosting your nodes, can solve some of the intrinsic routing issues and liquidity issues that exist in Lightning that aren't quite as prevalent in like other, we'll call them layer twos, right? Like, when I'm using a ETH layer two, it kind of, in some ways, it works better for some of my use cases than Lightning does today. But yeah, that gets to the point of just, you can be your own bank, right? And I'm curious, like, from your perspective, are you using, because I was using crypto for payments in El Salvador like daily. I haven't been using it here. Like, now it's more a good way to bring money in, at a very cheap way, and actually a pretty safe way. But I'm curious, like, are you using it for transactions here?
So that's an interesting question. I was about to say no, but it turns out I actually did. And this might be a particular problem that I have that you don't have because of the DNI. For my listeners, DNI is essentially your IRS number that is attached to every single transaction. You can't make online payments without one or without making one up or getting somebody else to get one. And so that's a huge barrier for me to get onto Mercado Pago. And Mercado Pago is like the PayPal of Argentina connected to the eBay and slash our
It's
Amazon.
a sick app. Like, you can do anything with that app if you have it.
And I want it. I want to become a full citizen, full participant in this whole thing. But it's going to take some time. So I am using Wapu Pay, which is, I believe, somebody you introduced me to, and I did interview him. And after the interview, I realized what they were doing. I didn't quite get it beforehand, but with that, I can transfer crypto into a wallet here in Argentina and then make payments in the Mercado Pago system without having Mercado Pago, without having a DNI. And so now I am actually using crypto for that. My main problem, this is kind of a tangent, I didn't really want to get into what you said about distributed computing and decentralized computing. The tangent is just the Coinbase, this whole system in the US of crypto, trying to make it like a bank. So it's like the same thing as the bank, as the online bank with full KYC, full all this crazy stuff. I don't want to have anything to do with that.
No, for sure.
But that's the only way that I can handle it as a US citizen. So there's something very interesting there, but it would be, I think it'd be more fun to talk about.
That's something I'm pretty bullish on, not to go too far on that, but that's something I like about Argentina, that it's such a cash heavy society. So all I have to do is use crypto, or we'll say all my friends have to do is use crypto to get physical US dollars. And then there's already a massive market for changing, like, on every street corner, basically, an exchange from US dollars to pesos. And it's like so legal that it's just like a storefront. Like, it's not sketchy at all. I have one on my street. I just like go in and like it's an open storefront. They give me a good rate. And so crypto is like so useful for that. But I kind of like the privacy aspect of that cash. And I haven't seen that yet in crypto, this privacy. And actually, something a guy who's currently extremely high up in the Milei administration was so bullish to me about Argentina. Like, I kind of came here, more for love than for other reasons. Just met my wife on a trip, as I mentioned, and yeah, we got married. So yeah, and I found this was just a good place to, like, we're expecting a son, to raise a family. I like all that aspects, and I kind of just assumed the government would suck. But then with the Milei administration, with their huge mandate, and then meeting a couple of Milei officials, it was just like, man, these people are, like, really ideologically aligned with, like, with crypto, with liberty, with things that I loved about the US, that, like, we were taught about the US that were, like, important and strong, and, like, defining reasons that the US has never became Argentina. And those have been
Now it
eroded.
is.
You
Now it is
mentioned
becoming
USC.
Argentina. This is the craziest part.
And
But
it's, yeah, it's weirdest thing. Like, it's running huge deficits. It has massive debt. It's printing a lot. I mean, people are upset about inflation now.
It's gonna get
And these
worse.
are structural. These are structural in the same way Argentina's are. And, fortunately for the US is like Argentina in that it's a massive country with ridiculous resources and, like, the best geography of any country. And so it has options. I'm not a doomer on it. I'm not like Peter Schiff on this, but I would. It does need to, it has structural deficits that are really big that, like, need to be resolved, which probably just means cutting entitlements like 30%.
Well, and it also, I think it would mean a fundamental shift in the US collective consciousness in the same way that Argentina's shifted, like, because this is not a new thing for Argentina, and a lot of people have tried to do what Milei is doing, but not with the same energy or vigor,
Exactly.
but also
Macri tried it without the mandate. Like, Macri, won the election. I'm trying to think. It was 2015. Yeah. Macri came to power in 2015, sort of pro-business, let's change the country. But he won with, like, 51%. So, like, he had, like, a 2-point spread on, or maybe 1-point spread. Milei won with, like, a 14% spread. So he has way better mandate to fix Argentina. But yeah, that's why I'm a little, that's another reason I really like living abroad. I just don't have to deal with watching my home country I very much love, just kind of become Argentina in these ways. And I'm not optimistic that they get a Milei in the next 4 or 8 years. It's probably like a 12-year thing, So yeah, that goes to, like, but on the Argentina side, the Milei administration, they're so ideologically aligned. And they get it. He's maybe perhaps a little bit too libertarian for my own taste, but his core economic people, like, are veterans. Like, they know, they're, like, veterans of, like, top US banks. They've been in the central bank before. They know, they got inflation down so quickly in Argentina. Like, that's a miracle.
It's crazy.
Getting the blue dollar is down. Like, the real rate of the peso versus Argentina, the peso strengthened in the last 5 months. And they got how it works. They fortunately got a massive harvest, which sounds stupid as an American. Like, we never talk about, like, the harvest. But for Argentina, like, having a good harvest is a huge deal. And they're coming off of the year before their worst harvest ever, like a huge drought. So now they have a bumper crop that pumps their foreign reserves. So Milei is, like, sitting on money to play with from the harvest. They're sitting on energy independence, and they have a popular mandate to get rid of the worst parts of Argentina, which is, like, doing business here is the same level of freedom as, like, the Congo. It's a joke. Has ridiculous capital controls that don't affect us as expats, but affect the
Any business
country,
person, any entrepreneur, and the
any
entrepreneur.
entrepreneur who's actually doing something, like, in Argentina versus what we do, which is more, in the ether.
Global. Yeah.
But yeah, I think, does that make sense? I'm surprised, actually, at how aligned they are. Like, it's they were telling me, like, man, crypto isn't private enough. And I was like, wait, really? Like, that's awesome. Like, obviously I believe that.
A rebrand of Monero backed by the
By
government.
the Argentine Central Bank.
By the burning ashes of the central bank. Let's see. That was the interesting thing about the Bhotad Mara interview, was that he mentioned that it's in order to actually get rid of the central bank, he needs a Congress to approve it, and that's going to be an interesting battle to actually fight.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because meeting with, like, talking to Malay people, they were skeptical on, well, I don't know. I think everything Bhotad said on that aspect is correct. Like, I think it's going to be competition between currencies, which for us is great. I actually don't really like how El Salvador went too in on Bitcoin, which is
Yes,
nice from a store of asset. But they miss the fact that, like, look, we're using Tether on Tron, you know, like means of payment, bro. Like, Tether on Tron works for like moving money across borders easily. For most, and if we had had that in El Salvador, a country that was on the dollar, right? If we could have easily done Tether on Tron for payments, like, dude, that would have been huge. But it's illegal to do that in, actually, maybe, that'd be interesting. Is that illegal in El Salvador? The government doesn't support it. So you're going to hit issues, basically.
They're not telling all the banks to get with it. I don't know how much time you have. I have another 40 minutes. We can, but I would love to, then we don't have to take
Yeah, I
that.
could do about 30. Yeah, 30 or so, I'm fine on.
Yeah, we could talk more about decentralized computing because that's so interesting. I'm going to start doing a series on kind of the evolution of what's going on right now and in that. And so what's your take on it and where are we headed with it?
Yeah, my high level take is I love this aspect of why am I blanking on his name? It's been too long, but the crypto renaissance idea. It was the most popular Banklist episode, and then they followed it up with a sequel. So you can look that up on the Banklist podcast. We also did a Network Age podcast on that same theme of the kind of crypto renaissance. And behind that idea, Josh Rosenthal, that's the name. Behind his idea was basically this, that looking at the Renaissance as this emergence of banking innovation, which was double book entry accounting, which sounds really boring, but actually was basically like self-sovereign, like decentralized ledgers where you had your own ledger, right? And your business had its own ledger you controlled through this innovation in accounting practices, which led to the Medici banking empire, which then obviously fed into, you know, Michelangelo, the Renaissance that we mostly study. But then he paired that with the printing press. So he kind of paired it with when you get this combination of financial innovation, sort of decentralized finance meets decentralized information, the printing press, you get disruption. And you get like a good kind of disruption. You get like reduced returns on violence, going back to the sovereign individual idea, because it's just too hard to kill all the printing presses. It's too hard to stop an idea. They couldn't stop the Protestant Revolution because all these towns had printing presses. They didn't need, you know, the Catholic scribe who'd been studying how to, like, you know, literally transcribe a manuscript for his entire life and like having hundreds of those scribes to build work. You just printed it. So the cost of information, the decentralization of information spread, mixed with this decentralization of money. We've had the decentralization of money. Like, I'm my own bank. We've talked at length right now about that, but I'm not really my own source of information. Interestingly, despite the internet, despite that, most of my information and most of yours, right, you post to Twitter. And I post, you know, under the handle at AlephDAO on Twitter. I haven't been super active recently. I'm kind of biding my time before I go back into the fray there. But
Quite
basically,
the fray.
but it doesn't feel Twitter and the current sort of like information side doesn't feel self-sovereign. I don't, and like a core and several core aspects of information self-sovereignty, kind of like identity. When identity, like if I sign a piece of paper, if Martin Luther signed a piece of paper, his treatise, like they knew it was Martin Luther. My identity is tied to other people's databases. I don't really own my own identity. From the urban perspective, that's something I really liked about it. This sort of I buy a sort of human pronounceable Nilrun Marduk's identity. It's recorded on the ETH blockchain forever. Anyone can look it up, and no one else can buy the exact same one. So I can kind of create a brand around that identity. And it's not as fragile as like my phone numbers. I've had to switch phones many times, my emails, if I get blocked on Twitter, I have like a solid bedrock foundation from identity that ETH, kind of linking up to Urbit, provided. But there's other aspects, right? There's like decentralized file storage. You know, I'm using Obsidian for my notes. And I'm not able to, you know, right now I'm backing up on Apple, but I'd love to back that up on Urbit or Keynote or some decentralized service where it's like, dude, I just want it. Like, I want the compute living on my servers, or, you know, ideally also backed up in an encrypted format to random people's servers as well. So I think it's a few core things to get to decentralized information, file storage, identities that you own that are immutable. Just an NFT. It could be any NFT, really. And then having control of your databases and having control of your computing environment. You know, Ethereum did this interesting pitch of like, we're the world's computer, but it's a blockchain. Like,
It's not a computer.
yeah, right. Like, it's amazing for financial data because financial data is valuable and worth, and has like sort of, you know, the classic problem of antagonistic interactions, right? Where like if you send me money, we both need to like have consensus around that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So I think we're in this interesting, I guess I would make the case like why I got really excited about Urbit was around decentralized computing. This was in 2019, when I first heard about it through my older brother. And then I got more, it was more like 2021 where I actually, you know, self-hosted a star, got like went more down that path. I also, you know, helped to organize the Urbit Volcano Summit in El Salvador last March. It was a really fun time. Actually, one of the best, like it was like a whole week, one of the best times ever, like hang out around a bunch of volcanoes with really interesting people. But I think on the negative side, right, Urbit has been slow to provide these primitives of decentralized computing that I need. And so I think that people are sincerely working all out on it. And they're fairly upfront about how it's like a big undertaking, big project. But the interesting thing about Urbit is it predates a couple technological innovations. Like Urbit predates crypto. Urbit was 2004. And so crypto provides some
Some of that,
advantages,
yeah.
right? And then you have WebAssembly that I'm not an expert. You know, I'm definitely not a systems engineer. Like I've done some app development. I've done a lot of like back-end data engineering, I've done data science and that stuff. I'm not a systems engineer, so I can't speak towards NOC versus WebAssembly. But when I talk to the people, right, NOC being sort of base layer computing that Hoon compiles down to, and then WebAssembly kind of similar where you could write on Rust and it's compiling down to WebAssembly. But Urbit predated WebAssembly, you know, which is now getting pretty popular, and it predated crypto. So I wonder, I'm just curious. I think there are use cases today that can be built on WebAssembly that can solve a lot of our general problems in the same way that like ETH on Tron is solving our problem today in Argentina. Like ETH on Tron is a joke, like, but it works for our use case. And so I think we need to be kind of more accepting that when we're going into decentralized computing, there might be certain architectures that work better for certain use cases, and maybe they don't last forever. Maybe it makes too much of a trade-off and eventually gets overtaken if Urbit can deliver. But you know, there's interesting stuff being built on WebAssembly. I'm an investor in Keynode, so I'll disclose that. But I wasn't positive what would come out of Keynode, but I'm bullish. You know, I did Hoon School, just I think the first six lessons. So I'm not a graduate of Hoon School, the Urbit's programming language, but it was way easier to kind of get set up on programming languages that I already know going on the WebAssembly route. Like shockingly so, refreshingly so for this sort of
Oh,
this,
interesting. Yeah,
yeah, you know, I don't know. Have you dived into, dove into, I don't know, Hoon or the WebAssembly stuff yet?
no,
I know
no,
you've interviewed a ton of the people.
yeah, no, I have not. I am, it's now coming back on my mind because for me, and something else that we haven't talked about yet, but is very interesting, is the we've talked about it in person, but not on the show, is the coding and the AI stuff. And so I am just going like blowing through things in terms of coding
Yeah.
that I like totally
Man,
really
is it refreshing, huh? Like it's so
overwhelmed.
refreshing. My first CS class was 2011. It was just like, why do I feel so stupid?
Yes,
You know
exactly. All the
what I mean?
time with no one to talk
It's
to.
also it was also the point where like my girlfriend at the time, if I was doing like heavy like because I was spending a lot of my day like, I don't know, writing like regressions and shit for my first job and like cleaning up data. And I would get home with like my girlfriend, you know, later first wife, and it was just like grueling to try to speak English after sitting in like a programming environment all for like the entire day for like 12 hours. And I find that's not the case anymore. Like I feel like I can focus on the business problem while creating an app that like solves the business problem and not ever lose the context. I don't know.
Yes,
been
the
powerful.
context switching. And so this gets into the Hoon stuff, is that now it's starting to appear on the realm of possibility, is that once I get HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and then React, and then Python, then that opens up, okay, maybe then I can start dipping my toes into. And now my strategy, which is really interesting, it's just coming about through this conversation, is essentially I use spaced repetition memorization in order to familiarize myself. And this is something that I picked up in 2015 when I first started coding, was that, and I hated coding, so I stopped using spaced repetition for coding, but then used it for all sorts of other things. Anytime there's a
And what
jar.
is it?
So
Or
spaced
what would be?
repetition, yeah, spaced repetition memorization software is quite a mouthful, but it's also a way that you can game memory. So everything that we're going to discuss in this conversation is going to be gone within 90 and within 4 days. 90% of it's going to be gone within 4 days, unless there's a strategic reminder on the third or fourth day. It then will then double the amount of time at which it disappears by. And this is really important because we don't want to memorize everything, because there's a lot of things that are irrelevant, but there's a lot of relevant information that we lose in our memory. And so spaced repetition is a way to essentially hold that and continue it. So it's really good for technical concepts, jargon. So as soon as I find jargon, I put it in there. And so for this particularly coding, it's now revolutionized, because now I have this AI agent who can answer all the questions I have, put it in the spaced repetition, and then I memorize it. And I forgot what I was, something to do with Hoon and WebAssembly.
You were saying you were going to finally get involved after you had like HTML, CSS, Python. It seemed like that's where I left off, but I'm not positive what you were getting involved with. Was it personal servers or?
Well, WebAssembly. So well, WebAssembly and Hoon, there's something going on there. And now that I realize that there's no barrier to entry for coding anymore, now I want to start to get into it and understand what's going on. So we got WebAssembly and we've got Hoon. So I didn't realize from this conversation that WebAssembly was actually the replacement or the competitor to Hoon, for
To NoC in particular.
to knock. I got it.
Yeah,
Okay.
the
To
computing
knock.
layer, the base computing layer, and then what is compiling down to WebAssembly would be like Rust, I think potentially Python. I don't know like the
Got it.
compiling chain. I'm not a systems engineer,
Oh, and that's go for it.
but basically NoC is competing with WebAssembly,
Got it.
mostly. And I think whether that's good or not, we can I don't know, we can dive into a little bit. I can't fully
Yeah,
say. I'm not smart enough to fully say, but I would say, that's the competition. It's between NoC and WebAssembly, and NoC predates WebAssembly,
and the key
right?
part I got is that the WebAssembly experience was easier to integrate with the legacy internet than NoC is. Is that accurate?
Yeah, because WebAssembly supports
Yeah, got it.
existing programming languages, and so that's like enough content, enough training has been done on those that it's like not that hard to build a WebAssembly app. Right, or to build a system on top of WebAssembly, like a peer-to-peer operating system, in the way Urbit is. So, that's what Keynode has been building. They've shipped like a open beta for just programmers right now. But it's interesting. There are some things that interest me about it. Like specifically, I would like to kind of have like my own personal server that has all my files, and but be able to share it to like certain identities that I whitelist. And they've already built that on Keynode. Whereas on Urbit, like they're working on large file storage, but like this just exists going the sort of Keynode WebAssembly route. So it's an interesting time. It might be a situation like, best case, it's sort of like the ETH versus Bitcoin situation, where ETH got programmable money and Bitcoin still doesn't have that. And
Yes,
that unlocked interesting
interesting.
things. They were the first ones to innovate with ZKs in a commercial way. And I think Bitcoin will eventually link into ZKs. I mean, that's already been talked about for years in the Bitcoin community. But there's things that ETH was able to solve that Bitcoin, due to its own set of values, which might be correct as a store of value. I'm not fully, can't really judge it. I think the price will say. And it has been actually outperforming ETH since the last bull
It has.
cycle.
Yep, it's true.
It has been, it's been locked at about 0.06 recently. But it did outperform. And so the people that were dooming about Bitcoin, like maybe Bitcoin just stays an amazing store of value, and ETH
Yes,
you know,
gets the
but
programmable
ETH
money.
has been this energy, yeah, programmable money engine of innovation, maybe getting a layer two that works better than Lightning does. I'm somewhat skeptical of Lightning. I think if we go back to that Lightning talk and like why do personal computers matter? I mean, I laid out like, look, you know, decentralized information I think will be big and we don't quite have it. Of course, now that X is owned by Elon Musk or Twitter, you know, is owned by Elon Musk, there's less of this sort of censorship that made it obvious in the kind of 2021, what was it? Was it even into 2022? But I'd say definitely during 2021, you know, we saw files that like Twitter is just sharing and it's having like weekly meetings with like the FBI and NSA. Like that's unacceptable. I don't want like weekly meetings to like figure out who gets blacklisted, like extremely communist. So it's more obvious then. Now that we have less censorship currently, it's slightly less obvious, but there's a lot like the crypto, we don't have great decentralized apps right now. Mostly crypto is being used for money. We don't have like these really cool peer-to-peer apps that are integrating with crypto yet. And so I think there's a very large addressable market. And I think, you know, there's always this question that will people run their own servers? The weird thing is like they're running their own like hardware wallets, you know? Like they're doing that. That's like not easy. Like using MetaMask is also like not particularly a good UX, but tons of like millions of people use it. And so interesting. I think there is a future where we build not all apps, but a lot of apps move into a decentralized architecture, due to kind of this sort of sovereign individual reason, talking about how like the current Western governments have massive budget deficits, and there has been sort of this concentration of power where they want sort of total surveillance. They want to make it really hard to start a business. They want to put you through all these like bureaucratic hoops to run that business once you've created it. You might have to hire people you don't want to hire. All these challenges that have been added into Western business over the last 100 years, you know, potentially the cyber economy that the, you know, sovereign individual talks about and that we now see after, you know, 30 years roughly since that book was written, we're seeing the emergence of a cyber economy. But the cyber economy is like nascent and it's not doing, it's still hard to do certain things in a cyber way. Like MetaMask still sucks, despite it being out for like, what, like 8 years or more. So I think decentralized computing can pair and complement crypto really well. The keynote people have written a lot about that. Urbit has also somewhat talked about it. I'm bullish on that. And if you look at the problems that crypto experts are talking about, like what they're trying to solve with layer twos, layer threes, with dApps, you know, decentralized apps, a lot of the things I think are going to be solved by either an Urbit or a WebAssembly peer-to-peer computer operating system.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So then there's an interesting thing that I said it was okay. So we're definitely entering into a new world. I love what it's really interesting because there's a really interesting tension between Keynote, Urbit, and Plunder. And I don't want to go too much into that tension specifically, but I do at a higher level, there's a sort of competition now. There's competition that
Definitely.
there are other people who have said, okay, distributed computing, that's something that we need to do, particularly with AI. That's my big piece now. I don't really, I have no ideological axes to grind. And this is the crazy part that wraps into what we're talking about is that
Oh, yeah, we didn't even mention AI in this whole
yeah,
battle.
I
Yeah,
know.
that's a huge part.
And this is wild because my audience has been just probably overwhelmed with how many episodes over the past 2 years I've done on AI. But now this is so critical. It's like so critical that as soon as these agents get autonomy, that they're under our control,
Yes.
rather than under the control of people who have are really interested in hacking into your thoughts and making sure that your thoughts are influenced in a particular way. Like that's the main incentive for any large centralized thing is to get into your thoughts and manipulate you in ways that have great business goals, but have nothing else besides a business goal.
Yeah.
And so
There's
but
more awareness. I think even before AI became like huge, there was awareness of the problems of letting algorithms just run wild
Yes,
on
yes.
you, like Instagram, Facebook.
Yep.
And now with AI and these open source models, there's like, I feel like there's this potential where if we can let the data live somewhere where we can then, we can basically have personal AI, right? We can not only get out of this shitty situation where the AI is doing things that help the underlying company that might actually be extremely harmful for us and our children. We can switch it to be like, hey, why don't we like get an AI that's actually like useful for what we're trying to do? Like buy me airline tickets based on my calendar. There's so many use cases, like hard to even like start. But the AI is huge on that aspect. I think it can, there's like suddenly a reason to have personal AI agents that are helpful for us because now the AI's the barrier to being helpful is low. We're using AI daily. It's already helpful, and that's when it doesn't even know a ton of our context. But like Cursor, for example, the company you mentioned to me that I've been using now in software development, it's great and it knows the context of my code. But I would kind of prefer it was like an open, I wish it wasn't using ChatGPT. I wish it was an open source model. I wish there was sort of no possibility the
Oh,
code goes out to Cursor or OpenAI.
that's a great idea. An open source competitor to both Cursor and Magic.dev, because Magic.dev is another one that's promising to
Yep.
be way, way more advanced than Cursor. That would be a very, very worthwhile project to do with.
Yep. And then on the other side, right, personal servers, like doing command line Linux, being like a Linux administrator sucks.
Yes. Interesting.
And AIs just know how to do that, right? Like you can just ask the AI, like, so the maintenance of your server is gonna be much easier. The maintenance of software in general is gonna be much easier because we have these AI. It doesn't even need to be open source for that, right? It's just like, hey, I'm getting these error codes. What does it mean? What do I run? It's already super useful for that. So I think the barrier to personal servers is lower and the value add to personal servers is higher due to AI, personal sort of AI assistance, and the sort of obvious need within crypto to actually get decentralized apps that work, that work beyond just things you store, apps that interact with blockchain data. Like those work. Apps that, only rely on blockchain data. Like the DeFi apps, those work. It's fine. But like most of data shouldn't live on a blockchain. Like it's either private and should never touch a blockchain, or it's just like not valuable enough to merit being on an L1, and it might not even merit being on like an L2 in a roll up. Like who knows?
Interesting.
But I think I don't, so that's the interesting thing with Urbit in the context of all these things, right? Because the WebAssembly approaches have actually they've had some advantages because of the fact that like there's more data to train those AIs on like how to build something on top of WebAssembly, and obviously how to build like a Python app or a React app. So the fact like WebAssembly is like compatible with these is huge. I think there's also there's underlying like the great. Why I'm bullish on personal servers, in addition to the things we mentioned, is what you said, competition. Like the reason I invested in Keynode, formerly Ukbar, was I had this view that it would drive competition within Urbit, and kind of break some of the sort of, I don't know, like at that point, Talon sort of had full control over Urbit. Like the Urbit Foundation wasn't even really powerful. It like didn't even exist at the point, I think, when I invested in Ukbar, later today, Keynode. And it did drive competition. Like a lot of the devs that worked on Ukbar did like took different approaches, were devs that weren't going to be hired by Talon, or maybe they had offers from Talon but wanted to do it differently. Talon being at that time the biggest Urbit company and just recently raised another round, like really good for them. It's great. But I wanted competition there. I wasn't expecting them to like go off of the Urbit stack into this WebAssembly approach. But I think it's even more bullish. I think it's really bullish for people who actually want personal servers, who want decentralized autonomy, who want privacy. Because now we have competition not just within like the Nok stack of apps that are building on top of Nok, as the computer for Urbit, but now we have competition across like different entire layers. Now there's a lot of WebAssembly projects launching off of WebAssembly. In terms of plunder, the other one that gets mentioned in this, I know one of their devs really well. He stayed at our house in El Salvador. Really good guy. Like, I don't know. It seems like all the guys are great there. I don't know enough to really speak towards their sort of technical approach, But it seems, if I had to bucket it, it would be more in line with Urbit, which is build everything from scratch, than the sort of Keynode WebAssembly projects that are more like, look, WebAssembly is great. Why don't we just use it to solve the problems we have today across these industries?
Yeah, okay. So last few minutes, I want to ask about Linux, because whenever I tell people who don't know about Urbit, who don't know about Keynote, don't know about Plunder, they always mention, well, what about Linux and specifically, what about Ubuntu? And then, so I recently tried to get Ubuntu on a personal server inside my own computer, and I couldn't even install it. And there's something that I couldn't figure out how to do, and ChatGPT was kind of helpful, and then I just lost motivation to do it. And that's like a that's just the normal thing. Whenever you're unless you're just a genius or autist or just it's insane, you just give up because the computer's so complicated, and the more that we go into consumer software, the more easy it gets to interact with software, and then the gap between that experience and the open source technically literate person. Their experience is just so vast that 80, 90% of people will never touch it. And I do think that that's probably going to be the same with Urbit and or any other personal server, unless there's some sort of really big change, which I don't expect. So what is it is like why isn't doesn't Linux or Ubuntu already give us all this stuff? Like, what's the difference between distributed computing and Linux slash Ubuntu?
So the thing that like jumps out to me is the fact that like Linux was built for like your own, more from like the sort of on-premises perspective. It was built, a very long time ago. It predates the internet. And so it never had this conception of computing that we're using today. It didn't have like the collaboration between computers is so critical to how we're using them. And it was built before the idea of collaboration between computers. It was built on the idea of like local networks, right? Like a university has their computing environment, and like you can correspond locally in that environment. Like if you're, I don't know, MIT or Harvard or something, you have your computer. It's running Linux, and like you can set up like a pretty decent environment for your university. But most of our computing today is over the internet. And so Linux just it hasn't been able to deliver in that. Like if you want to be by yourself, you'll have decentralized computing. If you want to like build a single player version,
Yeah,
Linux
got
seems
it.
good. If you want multiplayer, it seems really bad without adding in the sort of Web 2 approach, which is centralized servers, hosted by a couple big
Interesting.
companies. And so I'm kind of bullish there's an alternative model now, but I would just write Linux off as like, yeah, it did single player really well. It fell apart during multiplayer, which is why we went from Web 1 to Web 2. And now we're stuck with all of the problems we mentioned before with Web 2. And so with Web 3, where, Web 1 being read only for everyone, Web 2, it's like read and write, or to someone else's database. Web 3, it's like, okay, I can read and write and share and like do all these complex permissioning of my own database, right? And so I can have a file sharing system today built on top of WebAssembly where it's like Stuart's identity. Maybe it's an ETH address. Maybe it's built on some other blockchain, maybe even, Bitcoin as they're adding NFTs. That identity can access this set of files and then no one else can. And then like kind
Yes,
of just
brilliant. Okay.
real control over your computer and the simplicity to work with your AI to make that control easy to actually implement.
That's the interesting part is the control, because that's the fundamental difference between something like Android and Apple, or even Microsoft and Apple Windows, is or and then again, even more so with Linux, is the you have tons of control with Linux. But in order to know what to control, you need to be a programmer because you need to understand what are all the options for a computer, which I might be the same problem with Urbit with
And you're
Keynote.
going to have trouble working with anyone else on that. So you might build like the best app for yourself, but you're going to have a ton of trouble ever letting your friend interact with that app. Or like maybe it's file sharing, it's like a file note-taking app, right? And it's like, man, I love this app. I built it on Linux, really easy to do, really easy to control. Then it's like, oh, I need to share this note to someone else. And then you're suddenly trying to link it up to like probably some cloud service provider, right? And so, Yeah, it's the same. I think computers will eventually look back and have the same desire for ownership that we have over our money. If I talk to like the Europeans, they have like a really low desire for crypto because like giving central control
Well,
to
they
the
like
European
it.
banks kind of worked. Like they, well, for them, like they have like they're banked. It's free to kind of transfer. Credit cards exist. And it's when you go to the developing world where like banks don't work. And that's where those are the people that love crypto, right? So I think computing will be similar. We just like if you want to really want personal computers, just like the ones who want it the most are the ones where like Web 2 doesn't work for them. They're usually saying something that just isn't allowed in the Overton window of today. Those people want decentralized computers. But that as the Overton window, I would say actually narrows, shifts and narrows. More and more people will want decentralized computing because they want to be able to like talk to each other. Like when the truckers of Canada, they need to be able to communicate without Canada be able to like just hear it all and then figure out who to blacklist from banking apps. You know, information's critical. Messaging is critical, but it's critical in this sort of future that is unfortunately just like not as good as what we grew up in the US, where you wouldn't really need decentralized computing. Like it would help you, but you don't really need it. I think we're entering a period where it becomes more and more important in the same way that crypto becomes more and more important as countries kind of get extreme on their capital controls and kind of, yeah, or just don't have good tech.
I wonder what maybe the next episode we can talk about is the US headed for federal capital controls. I mean, I'm
Oh
sure
man,
a
it's
lot.
going to be one of the most interesting periods ever in the world because you have a reserve currency that a lot of people are still relying on. It's still pretty strong, even despite all the FUD around the dollar ending, but it also has like Argentina type structural problems. It's going to be fascinating. Yeah, I think hard to dive into it now, but it's crazy. Like the Fed had a paper, I think from last year, where they were talking about what the inflation rate has to be if you don't cut entitlements. And they were talking about cutting all, you know, like interest on federal debt, and you still have a 40% inflation if you don't cut entitlements. And then if you of like monetary inflation, right, which doesn't necessarily translate into eggs, it might translate into housing prices and stocks and crypto. People aren't always going to buy like, you know, consumer basic expendable goods. But then they talked about even if you get rid of all interest on private and federal debt, so basically if like JP Morgan wasn't giving out interest anymore, it's still an 8% inflation. So then the numbers are big. They're kind of shocking. And I think part of why the peso has actually strengthened over the last 5 months, despite the Argentine still inflating somewhat and still creating lots of currency, is related to this whole pumping in crypto that we're experiencing. Like the dollar weakened a fair amount. We see it because we live in Argentina, right? And so when the dollar weakens, suddenly our cost of living goes up. All these, you know, as a foreigner, it's particularly noticeable. But at the same time, crypto pumps, right? And so there are strategies to survive this like somewhat challenging transition. But it's fascinating. I think US, and I don't know. I don't know if the Americans are as experienced as like the Argentines are. Like the Malay government knows inflation. Like they've experienced it. It's real. And the people know it. And so maybe Janet Yellen knows inflation in the US. And she seems pretty experienced at her job. But like the American people doesn't seem to like fully get what it like really means. Like maybe you don't buy houses anymore. Like that's not that maybe
That
it's,
things change. Like
yeah,
it's not
things change.
the US 90s, and that's what got me. I think I just woke up to it a little bit earlier, but the fact that we're not in the 90s anymore. It's like we're not in the
No.
60s to the 90s anymore. We're not in that period anymore, and it's going to get really different. And so the US populace just like, oh, okay, well, the media told me that inflation's going down. They got it under control. We got to build some room. It's like,
Yeah, meanwhile, at the
no.
exact same time, the Fed is releasing a paper about how high inflation's going to be. Yeah, it's crazy. But I mean, you're an optimist, I'm an optimist. Like, I think the good thing, you know, I'm pretty committed to Argentina. We have a lot of good guys down here. So if there's people listening who like, you know, want to try out the adventure of living abroad or just want to like check it out for like a week, you know, like come down, like, I don't know, my email's like alephdao@gmail.com. Feel free to message me. We can loop you into the scene here, but I've just been shocked. Like I don't know. It's just like it doesn't feel like we have a better social scene here than I had in my home city, the US, which is a major US city. And, you know, we're well positioned against a lot of the problems that used to exist living abroad. We can earn our money in dollars and we can bring it in with crypto. So I don't know, I think it's a good picture. It's a challenging time, but also like an interesting time and kind of a fun time to be alive in a lot of ways.
Totally. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Stuart.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Stuart Alsop III. Also, don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or iTunes for every weekly episode that I publish on Monday mornings. Hope you have a great day.